Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we take you to a talk at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations with author and legal scholar Jack Goldsmith. The title of today's talk is The Decline of Congress in the Conduct of Foreign Affairs. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome everyone here today, as well as those who are listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 469th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, and we come to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look. The Midcoast Forum was founded in 1983. Tom corrected me last time I said 84. And for the last 40 years has been hearing from an invited speaker each month on an issue related to U.S. foreign policy. You can listen to audios of past forum talks and get information about upcoming forum speakers, as well as more information about the forum, on our website at midcoastforum.org. Recent forum talks are also on the websites of the Maine Public Radio and the Maine Monitor. If you're interested in current foreign affairs issues, please consider becoming a forum member. And the information on how to do that is on our website. Our speaker today is Mr. Jack Goldsmith, who is speaking on the decline of Congress in the conduct of foreign affairs. Jack Goldsmith is the Learned Hand Professor of Law at Harvard University. He is the author of a number of books, his most recent of which is After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency, and prior to that, a book on Jimmy Hoffa, entitled In Hoffa's Shadow, A Stepfather, A Disappearance in Detroit, and My Search for the Truth. He teaches and writes about presidential power, national security law, federal courts, conflict of laws, international law, and internet law. A lot of areas of law. Before coming to Harvard, Mr. Goldsmith served in the Justice Department as Assistant Attorney General, Office of the Legal Counsel, from October 2003 through July of 2004, and as Special Counsel to the General Counsel of the Department of Defense from September 2002 through June of 2003. He has taught at the University of Chicago Law School and at the University of Virginia Law School. He clerked for Supreme Court Justice Anthony M. Kennedy, Court of Appeals Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, and Judge George Ulrich on the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal. Mr. Goldsmith holds a Juris Doctor degree from Yale Law School, Bachelor of Arts and Master of Arts degrees from Oxford University, and a Bachelor of Arts degree from Washington and Lee University. Jack, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thanks very much. Thank you so much for inviting me here today. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you for that kind introduction. My topic, the decline of Congress in the conduct of foreign relations, seems like a familiar story. The decline of Congress is an evergreen topic. And I'm going to focus on that topic, focusing primarily on two areas, war powers and international agreements. And one of the stories I want to tell is we think of constitutional law and the development of constitutional law as something that takes place in courts, something that the Supreme Court's involved in, the Supreme Court over time responding perhaps to changed circumstances in the nation, changes in values, sometimes updates or changes or the Constitution. And so the Constitution today, as it's practiced, looks very different from the way it did in 1789. I'm going to tell a story of constitutional change that takes place outside of the courts, because I'm going to tell a story about how the Constitution was supposed to work in 1789, how it works today, and it's basically dramatically different. Some of this story will be familiar to so many of you who are expert in foreign relations. Some of it hopefully will contain some news. So this is the table of contents. I'm going to talk about the relevant constitutional background, the decline of Congress in regulating war, the decline of Congress in making international agreements, and then I'll briefly assess what's happened. First, the constitutional background. So, as you know, the Articles of Confederation, the first constitution that the United States had, there's an argument about whether it was a constitution or a treaty or something in between. But whatever it was, it did not have an executive branch. It had Congress, and it didn't really have federal courts either. There was just a Congress. But there's a need for a nation to have executive functions like negotiating treaties, enforcing the law, leading the troops into the field. And the executive branch in the Articles of Confederation was actually inside the Congress. And for a whole bunch of reasons I can't get into here, that system didn't work very well. So one of the main reasons for the founding of the Constitution was the failures of the Articles to conduct foreign relations for a whole bunch of reasons. One of the first things the founder that they realized they needed was an independent executive branch, and they needed it to enforce the law, to engage in a number of foreign relations functions, and to be the leadership of the military on the battlefield. So they created this independent executive power. But in doing that, they were very careful how they allocated the war power. And they gave almost all of the war powers to the Congress, and I've listed them here. The most important one was the power to declare war. That essentially means the power to initiate war, although there's some controversy about that. The power to grant letters of marque, which is basically the power to authorize private entities to engage in war fighting during war. The third one is a very important power, it was to the framers, the power to raise and support armies with appropriations every 2 years. The framers were deathly worried about a standing army because they believed that if there was a large standing army, the president would use it, and the president would use it to start wars. And there was a big debate about whether standing armies would even be allowed. And there was a debate about whether they should or shouldn't be allowed. And the compromise was, we'll allow them, but Congress has to reauthorize them through appropriations every 2 years. That was a procedural fix that ended up not preventing the rise of a standing army. And other powers, lots of them allocated to the Congress, and the president was given one power related to war. He was designated the commander-in-chief of the military and of the militia. And there's some debate about what that meant, but at least it meant that there would be a civilian in control of the military during conflict and wartime. Now, the framers were clear about what this system meant. I'm not going to read these quotes, but basically, and I could reproduce many quotes like this, basically, the framers were clear that they thought through the scheme that I just went through, by giving Congress especially the power to declare war and the power over appropriations, they thought that the Congress could check the president and would keep the president from going to war, because what they worried about was that one person could, by initiating war, put the whole country in jeopardy. And they wanted to make sure that this most monumental of decisions to go to war was made through a two-branch deliberation. That was their primary concern, and they thought they achieved that in the system I set up. That was the war understanding. As for international agreements are obviously a hugely important part of the conduct of diplomacy and international relations. And here again, the framers were clear. They gave the power to make treaties to the president, but, and this is from Article 2, this first quote, but they said that the president had to secure two-thirds of the senators present, the consent of two-thirds of the senators present for the treaty to be made. And this was a very important power because treaties not only establish relations with foreign countries, but treaties in our system are like laws. They're the functional equivalent of statutes, and they count as domestic law just as a statute does, which is what the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution says. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. So a treaty, at least certain of them, count as a statute. So this is not something you want the president alone to do. You want two-branch involvement for treaties. For many of the same reasons, you want two-branch involvement for statutes. And Hamilton was articulated the classic view of why you didn't want the president alone to be able to make international agreements. The first part of this quote is about how, yes, that it's very important to have a president who can negotiate. The president has unity, the president has energy, the president can organize that branch hierarchically, the president can act in secrecy, the president can conduct negotiations and diplomacy. But the vast importance of the trust and the operation of treaties as laws, i.e. the importance of these things and the fact that they operate as laws, plead strongly for the participation of the whole or a portion of the legislative body in the office of making them. So the idea is the president would negotiate and make them, but he needed the consent of another branch. In the case of what they finally fell on was this two-thirds consent by one branch, the Senate. And this I'll call the principle of joint collaboration. Hamilton, in the same Federalist 75, said the history, and he's again warning about the dangers of a president being able to make agreements on his own. The history of human conduct does not warrant that exalted opinion of human virtue, which would make it wise in a nation to commit interests of so delicate and momentous a kind as those which concern in intercourse with the rest of the world to the sole disposal of a magistrate created in circumstance as would be a president of the United States. The idea is you don't want one person alone, no matter, even though elected, deciding these hugely fateful agreements, just as you don't want the president alone to decide whether to bring the country to war. That's the constitutional background. It's pretty clear. It's a principle of the president needing to get ultimate permission from Congress to go to war or to make an international agreement. And the idea was that that would ensure that the national interest would be served, both in going to war and in making agreements. Okay. That's not the way it worked out. So if you want to understand why the president ended up being able to use military force abroad without congressional authorization on an increasing scale over the course of American history, this slide explains it. Very simply, after each major war, the standing army, i.e. the army that was still constituted, grew and grew and grew. And the equipment for the standing army remained and grew. And basically, there's almost a perfect line between the rise of the standing army and the rise of presidential unilateral use of force abroad. If presidents have these tools at his or her disposal, they have used them. And just to give you one example of how the framers thought these things were supposed to work, the first major war the United States was involved in, the quasi-war of the 1790s with France, President Adams wanted to, the French were preying on American commercial ships growing out of the French Revolution, and President Adams wanted to send American ships and troops to protect American shipping. Sounds like a good idea. Might he have done it unilaterally? No, he couldn't have done it unilaterally. Why? He didn't have the troops and he didn't have the ships. He had to go to Congress, they had to build the ships, they had to pay for the troops, and once those were together, he had the means to engage in this war, which Congress had authorized. Now, there may be downsides with that system, but that was the system as it was supposed to work. So you can see the growth of the standing army, and basically, presidential use of force without congressional authorization has grown as Congress has provided. And by army, I mean all of the military services here. The president has justified using force without getting congressional permission. And I'm going to go through some examples, but the examples are legion. Really, throughout the late 19th century, the early 20th century, the middle of the 20th century, and continuing through the late 20th century and in the 21st century, and I'll give some examples in a moment. But we know the examples, the Kosovo War, everything President Biden is doing right now in the Middle East. There's no authorization from Congress to do that, almost everything. The war in Libya, the war, the Grenada, the war against the invasion of Iraq was in 2003 was authorized by Congress, but the Bush administration claimed that it didn't need that authorization because of the self-defense rationale I'm now about to explain to you. There have been dozens of examples in recent decades of presidents of both parties using force without congressional authorization under two rationales. The first is the self-defense rationale, and it builds on Madison's statement at the convention that the executive has the power to repel sudden attacks. Now, there's nothing in Article 2 of the Constitution that says that, but it makes sense that the president, if the country is attacked, should, and with whatever standing army he has, shouldn't have to wait around to protect the country. That was a pretty common understanding of the convention. And that wasn't very controversial. But that idea expanded quite dramatically over time. It expanded, if I had to summarize, it expanded in these four respects. First, starting in the mid-19th century, presidents started exercising self-defense, not to protect invasions at home, but to protect attacks on American persons and property abroad. You might think that's a small step, but it was a very important step. The next large step, and that rationale grew and grew and grew and grew as the United States presence abroad grew and as United States military power grew, there was a growing need to defend the troops and defend American persons, defend American property. Second is something called unit self-defense. Wherever U.S. troops are around the world, and we have 750 military bases in 80 countries, wherever American troops are around the world, if they are attacked, the president can without, or any sort of attack, the president can without congressional authorization defend them. That's another expansion of this Madisonian idea. Then there was a temporal expansion, and it didn't start, it was most controversial during the Bush administration, but it didn't start and it didn't end there. And this is the idea that you can attack in anticipation, in self-defense, in anticipation of an attack. You don't have to wait for an attack, you can do it in anticipation. And the United States has increasingly stretched the notion of what counts as anticipation to justify earlier and earlier attacks. And finally, collective self-defense. The United States government regularly now claims that it can use force not just to protect U.S. property, persons, interests, or troops, but to protect allies, as the president deems these allies to be. Now, I wrote a piece about 6 months ago saying that anything President Biden wants to do in the Middle East right now, literally anything that he thinks is worth doing strategically, he can do under one of these rationales. We have such a huge troop presence, we have so many allies, the threats are ever present, that basically and he has been exercising self-defense throughout the region. I'm not making a normative judgment yet, I'm just trying to explain it. You might think that's a great thing, you might think it's a dangerous thing, we'll get to that in a second, but that's the theory. There's another theory, all of these theories have been articulated in legal memoranda from the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department where I used to work. This is one of the opinions here from 2011. They've developed a theory that the president can use force even not in self-defense, but just offensively. Even with these broad self-defense rationales, you don't have to rely on those. The president can use military force unilaterally if he can, quote, reasonably determine that the action serves important national interests. That's the test. It's not hard to imagine important national interests, I can tell you. And there's a long list of them, and they're not exclusive. There's one limitation on this test, and that is, and it's not even clear how well established this is, and that is that the president need only go to Congress for if he's going to engage in prolonged and substantial military engagements, typically involving exposure of U.S. military personnel to significant risk of over a substantial period. If there are going to be a lot of troops on the ground for a long time exposing themselves to danger, that is the one situation where OLC says you have to get approval from the president. We live in a world, however, at least for the last couple of decades and probably going forward, of warfare from a distance or light footprint warfare. The means of engagement now are not heavy footprints, at least since the Obama administration. I don't think this is going to change for a while. The means of engagement are light footprint warfare, missiles from a distance, cyber attacks, drones, All of these things, under this rationale, the president can use whenever he thinks the national interest calls for it, in any country. End of story. The upshot is, and this is not an exaggeration, is basically the president can use almost all of these massive military tools at his disposal when the president thinks it's in the national interest to do so, or when he has one of these very broad self-defensive rationales. And that is clearly quite different from what the framers thought should happen. And these are this is the rationale that's been used in one or other of these versions, or both have been used in all of the recent conflicts in the Middle East. I mean, you read the paper, you've probably become immune to it, but we're always firing rockets in self-defense, missiles in self-defense, launching attacks in self-defense, or sometimes offensively, and no one pauses to ask what's the legal basis for that, because I'll get to that in a second, but these are the legal rationales. There is something called the War Powers Resolution. You may remember this from the 1970s when Congress famously, the resurgent Congress in the mid-1970s, pushed back against Nixon, Vietnam, Watergate, and the like, and passed a lot of famous reforms, one of which was the War Powers Resolution. In a nutshell, I'm happy to talk about this more later, in a nutshell, the War Powers Resolution says that 60 days after the president introduces hostilities, he has to stop using force and his authorization runs out and he has to bring the troops home. Full story. End of story. There's a 30-day add-on in an emergency, basically. Presidents have basically ignored this. You probably don't know this, but President Biden is almost certainly in violation of the War Powers Resolution right now. Why is he probably in violation of the War Powers Resolution right now? He's been engaging with the Houthis since last fall or last December, depending on how far you count. That is an engagement in hostilities. He's reported that engagement of hostilities to Congress. The 60-day and now 90-day window have run. Has anyone in Congress said or done anything? No. Have you seen reports about it in the New York Times? No. It's a useless statute. The reason it's a useless statute is two reasons. The executive branch, I'm guilty of this, I did this myself. The executive branch, through a long list of precedents, has found a dozen loopholes in the War Powers Resolution. It's basically Swiss cheese. And, more importantly, Congress does not care. Congress simply has not stood up and said, you're violating this law is important to us. Absent Congress pushing back, which it's either doesn't want to or is incapable of, and we can talk about that later, this law is a dead letter, and it is a dead letter. Why the decline of Congress in war? There are a whole bunch of reasons. It's part of a much larger trend shifting power from Congress to the executive branch. This is happening along every dimension because, and there are too many reasons to talk about, Congress being obsessed with re-election, Congress delegating massive authority to the executive because it doesn't want responsibility for the hard decisions, so it can instead focus on re-election and also sit back, see how the president does, and then either take credit or criticize, depending on how things turn out. Congress has given the president this massive standing army with massive weapons with very few conditions on their use. Presidents, and again, I'm not making normative judgments yet, presidents under various pressures are the ones that we have come to think are responsible for using these tools, and they use them as they see fit. Obviously, the world has grown much more dangerous since 1789, and especially since World War II and the advent of nuclear weapons, it's been thought that the president needed to be able to act quickly in dangerous situations in war, and that's become part of the constitutional culture. As I said earlier, Congress doesn't want responsibility for these decisions. Hugely important point is that the way war is conducted now, and this was one of President Obama's, I was going to say great innovations, I'll call it an innovation, and you can decide if it's great or terrible. President Obama figured out that if you engage in warfare with drones and from a distance and with special operations forces on the ground and through cyber, such that A, it's not really in the headlines at home because B, no Americans are being killed, then you can do what you want, especially with there's an all-volunteer army. So our country is involved in military force all around the globe. And unless you know someone in the military involved in these operations, we're basically, as a country, completely disengaged. War fighting has become disengaged from the democratic process. It's just not, it's hardly connected at all. Congress is not completely out of it. They're appropriating every year. Congress is ultimately on board for this. They're appropriating every year. And sometimes in tiny ways they push back. But basically, stealth warfare has taken it off the democratic agenda. Finally, there's always a rally around the flag effect, at least for a short term, when the president uses force, even in controversial contexts. Okay, there's more to say about that, but time is short, so let's move on to what's happened to the treaty power. There are a whole bunch of other ways of making agreements. This gets a little technical, and I'm going to try to dumb it down, not because you need it dumbing down, just because it's insanely technical. There are lots of forms of international agreements besides what the treaties that were contemplated by Article 2 that I mentioned. They're called executive agreements. The basic idea is that there are other ways for the president to make agreements besides treaties. And all of these ways, or almost all of them, are easier than making treaties. And these are substitutes for the treaty process. I'm going to focus on two. So-called ex-ante congressional executive agreements, that's a mouthful. All that means is that rather than the president negotiating a document and bringing it back to the Senate and the Senate debating and approving, Congress by statute says, you, the president, are hereby authorized to make the following types of agreements. You figure out what should be in it. Here's a little bit of guidance, but you figure it out. Something like 90% of all binding U.S. international agreements are made that way. I have two here. I could have 200. The Mutual Defense Assistance Act of 1949 says the president shall conclude agreements to effectuate the policies and purposes of this act. That's pretty broad delegation. Gives some general guidelines. And now the president can make agreements and doesn't have to go to the Senate, doesn't have to go back to the Congress. It makes it much more efficient. It's a massive delegation of agreement-making power to the president. The Foreign Assistance Act of 1961 authorizes the president to enter into agreements committing appropriated development funds. So Congress appropriates development funds. There's a general list of criteria. The president decides, and he can make agreements along these lines. And just every single topic you can imagine is covered by these agreements, which flip the treaty process on its head. The president doesn't negotiate and bring it back for approval. Congress approves in advance, and the president can do what he wants after that. Then there are so-called sole executive agreements, and these are agreements that the president makes on his own constitutional authority. He doesn't have to even talk to Congress about it. And I've listed three famous ones, but there are many more. Roosevelt's Litvinov Agreement in 1933, recognizing the Soviet Union and settling up the property disputes, the expropriated property disputes between the Soviet Union and the United States. Roosevelt's famous Destroyers for Bases deal at the dawn of World War II to try to help Great Britain. And the Algiers Accord in 1981, which was the agreement that ended the hostage standoff in Iran and led to the hostages coming home and the opening of the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal to settle disputes. These were very important consequential agreements that the president did on his own authority. Far cry from the treaty process contemplated by Article 2. So here is a map about the decline of treaties. There are many ways to do this. The bottom line is, as you can see, executive agreements, they got going early on. The earliest executive agreement was, i.e. non-treaty, was a postal agreement made in the 1790s, an international postal agreement where Congress by statute said the president can negotiate postal agreements with other countries so that we could have cross-border mail. So we had executive agreements early on, but the treaty process still dominated. For the first 50 years of the country, almost 70% of the international agreements that the United States made were done by this rather more difficult Senate process. And you can see over time, it basically flipped. And basically, in the last, since 1939, about 5 or 6% of all international agreements have been done by treaty, the only process mentioned in the Constitution. And the other 94% or so have been done by some form of these executive agreements, which, as I say, are much more efficient, much easier. They don't exactly all cut Congress out of the process, but Congress's collaborative role is significantly diminished. Here is treaty since 1990, and as you can see, the treaty process is almost ground to a halt. In the Clinton administration, there were 60 treaties at the end of the Clinton administration. President Biden, I don't take this all the way through 2024, is going to hit an all-time low. There will have been four treaties made that the Senate consented to during the Biden administration. That's going to be, best I can tell, an all-time presidential low. We just don't use this process anymore. It's dead. And more broadly, the real point I want to make is what's really dead is the collaborative role that the Congress has. Either the Senate process, or there's another form of agreement, which I didn't talk about, called ex post agreements, where it's just like a treaty where the president negotiates it and takes it to the Congress for approval afterwards. NAFTA was done this way, for example. And that's real collaboration because the president has to actually bring what he negotiated to Congress for its approval. So this top part is real collaboration because Congress has to approve after the negotiation. But the vast majority of agreements don't have little or no collaboration. Either Congress gives away the store before the president negotiates, or it's an executive agreement where the president's not involved at all. And here this is represented just in a pie graph. So the blue is the number of agreements made without congressional collaboration, and the white is with congressional collaboration. But this is a highly misleading graph because it only includes binding agreements. Those of you who worked in the State Department and maybe other parts of the government know that a lot of agreements, hugely important agreements made today, are not any of the things I've been talking about. I've been talking about agreements that are binding under international law, but there's another form of agreement called non-binding agreements or political commitments. These are, in effect, presidential handshakes. They look like treaties. They have whereas clauses, they have articles, they sometimes have entry into force dates and the like, but they're not ratified, they're not governed by international law. They're basically handshakes where the countries pledge to agree to these things, but there are no legal promises made. And these are increasingly important in international affairs. Why? It's easier for the president to do. The president does not have to go to Congress for these things. There's no limit on the kinds of agreements the president can make. Many of the most important examples of international agreements in the last 20 years have been non-binding agreements. The Iran deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that's a non-binding agreement. That's a handshake. Hugely important. It worked for a while. It's a handshake. The Paris Agreement on Climate Change, 2015, that itself was a binding agreement, but the core emissions pledge in it about the commitment to reduce emissions, that was a non-binding agreement. Why were those agreements non-binding? Why did President Biden go the handshake route instead of going to Congress or the Senate and getting their approval? Why did he do that? He couldn't have gotten their approval. So the choice was no agreement or a handshake agreement. And he went for the handshake agreement. These are some other very important agreements in the last 10 years that have been done by non-binding agreements. And as this chart shows, this is from some scholarship from a couple of years ago that I did with two other authors. Non-binding agreements have been on the rise just as binding agreements have been declining. And when you put the non-binding and binding agreements together, joint collaboration, because the non-bindings don't have anything to do with Congress, the president can do whatever he wants, we're really down to a very tiny sliver of all American international agreements in which Congress is even involved. Why the decline in joint collaboration? In clear contravention of what Hamilton believes should be the case, this principle of joint collaboration. Again, it's part of this broader trend of shifting power from Congress to the executive. There's an increasing demand for international agreements in many ways, but there's a very high bar to treaties. Two-thirds of the Senate is tough to get, and frankly, even getting a statute to approve is tough to get, especially in a world of rising partisanship and increased polarization and rising anti-internationalism in the Republican Party especially. Presidents who need to get things done go this route. Now, it's not a perfect substitute. A non-binding agreement is not a perfect substitute, the Paris Agreement, the Iran deal. To do that without Congress seems great. You can get it done, but it's not perfect because it's just a handshake. And what did President Trump do as soon as he got into office? See you later. That was just a handshake. It's gone. That's a very quick 40,000-foot overview of the decline of the role of Congress in war and in international agreements. These are arguably two of the most important elements of U.S. international affairs. It's hard to think about what might be more important. Diplomacy is always, of course, aside from these things, but agreements and war subsume most of the modes in which the United States engages the rest of the world. So what are we to make of this? So it would take me another 40 minutes to assess this, and I don't have time. Let me just say the following. I'll just say three or four things, and then maybe we can talk about this with your questions. On the agreements front, there's a trade-off, and Obama faced it squarely. Non-binding agreements, which are really the dominant mode now, the handshake agreements, they can work. The Paris Agreement was working. Excuse me, the Iran deal especially, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, even though it was just a handshake. When I say just a handshake, I mean it wasn't governed by international law. There were no legal sanctions attached to it. It was working, and agreements can work through non-binding agreements, but they're fragile. They can fall apart more easily. They're hard to persist. They're less stable for that reason, and they're less credible. The nation, as a nation, we're not really committing in the way we would commit if the legislature was behind it and the other countries could see that the nation was behind it. It's basically the difference between a president agreeing and the nation agreeing. There's also the question about the rise of presidential power in making whatever agreement he or she wants. The question that Hamilton raised is, can we always trust the president? This is the same question I'm going to ask in war. What you think about the rise of presidential power and the decline of congressional power to make international agreements might depend on your view of constitutionalism, might depend on your view of whether you like the agreements or don't like the agreements the president's making. It might depend on whether you like the president that's making the agreements. But what's happening, though, is the nation's fate is being put in one person's hands, the president. And that is a hugely momentous responsibility. And, you know, I think most of us aren't aware of this, but basically it's the president making agreements. And on the war front, I think we're a little bit more aware of it. There, it's just as momentous. And again, it depends on your view of these things. If you think that we need a robust military presence where the president can make quick decisions, and if you trust the president to make prudent decisions, then maybe you're okay with that, especially if you think Congress would muck up the works and make things harder and the like. But from a constitutional perspective, it's really fraught to have one person and that person's advisors basically deciding whether World War III is going to be started, as it arguably almost did in Iran, when the United States exercised self-defense from that barrage by Iran into Israel a couple of months ago, I guess it was. And you might like the current president, but you might not like the next president. And so is this system a prudent system where basically Congress has gotten out of the game and given all of these powers, both to make agreements and to decide whether and when to go to war and under what circumstances, to the president? It's a very, very dangerous state of affairs, and I will stop there and take your questions.
Thank you, Jack, for alerting us to some things I don't think a lot of us think about all that often. An obvious question seemed to me, today's world is considerably different than the world of our founding fathers in the 1780s. Is it at all practical in today's world to go back to a system that was anticipated by the founding fathers, where all of these agreements, and there are now thousands of them, as you've indicated, would have to go to Congress?
It's a great question. The answer is probably no. The reason, I mean, there are many reasons why the changes I talked about happened, and one of them was simply because it was infeasible for the treaty process, the two-thirds Senate process, to, and this happened early on. They realized this early on that they needed other processes, and the change to executive agreements happened, you can't really find it in the text, it happened out of functional necessity. So I don't think that we could go back to what was contemplated in Article 2, but there's a large space between that and the system we have now where Congress is basically checked out completely. There are lots of intermediate possibilities of Congress being engaged and scrutinized in these agreements more. And frankly, you know, presidents do things all the time that Congress, a majority in Congress, don't approve of, but they can't do anything about it because it would require passing a law and defeating an overriding a veto. So the president has the initiative. My view is that there needs to be a balance, but the balance has gone too far in favor of the president.
It's obvious to me already that there are a number of questions related to whether there's anyone in Congress, in the Senate, that's really worried about this and taking any of this into account, or why Congress hasn't reasserted itself in this presidential power takeover.
So I've got bad news on that front. The senator who was most concerned about the president making agreements that weren't being reported to Congress, that maybe weren't lawful, that that was exceeding his authority in doing this, and the senator who helped enact some very important legislation two Decembers ago, that was one of the most important accountability measures in Congress in this area in a long time, was Senator Menendez. And he's not long for the Senate, I don't think.
He's going to run again.
Senator Kaine is the leading voice in Congress on the president using excessive force without authorization. And he's made great efforts, but the truth is Congress is, here's the truth. Congress is not interested in getting into this game. They talk like they are, but they never do anything about it because they don't want to have to take, my assessment is they don't want to have to take responsibility. They want the president to have the responsibility.
Then could you contrast the U.S. from other major democracies in the world today in terms of war powers and
I can't really. I'll say this. I can tell you a couple of things about my talk in comparative law, and I'm not an expert on this. Surprisingly, the United Kingdom has been moving in the opposite direction. They've been moving towards requiring more parliamentary approval for the use of force abroad. I don't know enough to know why. And also, but this trend of using non-binding agreements instead of agreements that require the ratification of the legislature, that's a global trend. And this is a marked global trend. We did a study of this, and we had lots of input from other countries. And there's just a global demand for less formal agreements that circumvent the legislature. So in that front, we're not unusual globally, although it still raises domestic constitutional questions.
And someone comments that lots of agreements are hard to negotiate when the U.S. representatives cannot commit automatically. This frustrates the other side. Is this one of the reasons why we're shifting to, you know, executive only?
Is the argument that the nations we're negotiating with don't like to negotiate with the United States because the president says, here's what I'd like, but I have to take it back and get it approved from the Senate? Is that the idea? And So yes, we do have this has been a perpetual problem for the United States, and different countries have different ratification systems. In parliamentary systems, when the executive negotiates, then the executive can basically guarantee that it'll be ratified by the legislature. In this country, we can't. This has always been a hurdle for the United States in negotiating agreements. In some sense, it's been a power, because the president can credibly claim, if you can't give me this concession, these people in the Senate aren't going to pass this, so if you want this passed, you've got to give me this concession. So it's been to our benefit, but it's also been to our detriment. I would say my assessment is that the reason for this shift of circumventing Congress has less to do with having to deal with our allies and more to do with not wanting to deal with Congress, because Congress is going to say no.
And someone wants to ask, can we repair the move to executive agreements, especially the non-binding? As you commented, they're fragile. Are they really to our benefit to do this if one president can agree to it and the next one can?
Well, let me say two things about that, because I left a piece out of that story. So are they in our benefit? Ask yourself this hypothetical. Are we better having the Paris Agreement with this very fragile non-binding provision embedded in it, which is the most important provision? Is that better for the world? The Paris Agreement is kind of limping along, but still better than nothing if you believe that climate change is a serious problem. Is that better or nothing? A lot of people would say that's better if you think climate change is important. Same with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. It worked for a couple of years. Trump stopped it. The alternative was no agreement. So that's the reality you're living with. No agreement or a fragile agreement. And let me also say, treaties and executive agreements, treaties are fragile too, because the president has authority, usually with a one-year delay, but has the authority to terminate a treaty. So treaties are stickier and they're less fragile, but they too are subject to presidential abrogation.
And there's several questions related to what's meant by international law. At one point during your talk, you put international law in air quotes, someone says. Was that unwitting or was that intentional?
So I wrote a book called The Limits of International Law. And I am in the academic world on the skeptical end of international law, in thinking that international law somehow, if you say international law governs an agreement, through some magic fairy dust, it's going to be thereby more enforceable than it otherwise would. So I'm skeptical of that view. I'm not skeptical of international law. No one can be skeptical of international law. International law is a reality. So much of your daily lives are made possible by international law. International air travel, fresh fruit from other countries, everything that we benefit from in trade. So much of your lives are, believe it or not, infused with or supported by or enhanced by international law. So I don't know where I put it in air quotes. I think that international law has a reality. But its reality is embedded in politics, and it's embedded in whether these agreements serve the interests of the countries involved. And the agreements tend to dissipate and break down when they don't serve the interests of the countries involved. And that's really true of the United States. We are at the leading edge of violating international law obligations when we find that they don't suit our interests, I'm sorry to say. That's my answer about international. I could go on more if you like.
And someone wants to know about the role of the Supreme Court in all of this. Can't the Supreme Court step? Could you bring a case before the Supreme Court where they could step in and talk about how these actions relate to the Constitution?
No. The answer is no. And here's why. So I said at the beginning, this is a story of constitutional change without the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has barely ever considered a case involving war powers. I mean, by war powers, I don't mean things that happened during war. There are obviously a lot of cases like that after 9/11. I mean the president's use of force, the president's decision to initiate force. The only real case that came up in the Supreme Court was the prize cases in the Civil War, where the Supreme Court basically said that it was okay for Lincoln to establish a blockade of the South without approval from Congress. These cases do not make it to court because the court, through a variety of doctrines, who has standing to bring the case, and most importantly, the court has deemed it to be a political question. The court has stayed out of this question, and I don't expect that to change on the war front. And basically the same on the law front. There's never been a case in the Supreme Court involving a non-binding agreement, never. I looked very hard. There's one close in the 1880s. There's never been a case in the Supreme Court about whether it's okay to use a congressional executive agreement instead of a treaty. These cases tend not to be litigated because they tend not to have rights to sue attached to them and parties who are injured in the right way where they can bring the case in federal court. So that's why I said at the beginning, this is constitutional law outside the courts, which is an alien concept to many, but it's not an alien concept. I worked in the executive branch. I was a top executive branch lawyer, and there's a whole parallel body of executive branch law to Supreme Court law that governs the executive branch. And there's a little bit of interaction and overlap, but it's a large mistake to think that constitutional law is all happens in the Supreme Court and is only what the Supreme Court says.
Someone wanted to ask the question of how did the Office of Legal Counsel come to have so much power? You were talking about.
So the Office of Legal Counsel's power is the president's power. The President of the United States is vested with the executive power by Article 2 and with the duty to take care to faithfully execute the law. And the duty to faithfully execute the law, you can't faithfully execute the law and you can't enforce the law until you interpret it. Interpretation, enforcement and compliance presupposes interpretation. You have to know what the law means. The law is often unclear or complicated. So from the very beginning, from George Washington's administration, presidents have asserted the authority to interpret the law as part of their duties. And the reason the Office of Legal Counsel has such extraordinary authority is the president, through the Attorney General, has delegated that authority to OLC. And so OLC makes these decisions, and I'm simplifying a complicated story, but basically subject to being overruled by the Attorney General or the president, which rarely happens. So it's the president's power ultimately that's being exercised here is the point. And the president has plenary authority to interpret law for the executive branch, believe it or not.
Someone wants to know if you could comment on not only the legal framework for getting us into conflicts like Afghanistan, but also with the withdrawal. Does Congress have any role once we're in these conflicts and getting us out? Or?
Yes, and it has exercised this power occasionally. So the Vietnam War ended ultimately when Congress decided to defund it. And ultimately, Congress's power of the purse in war is its ultimate power. It still has that loaded gun if it wants to exercise it. And if you can get enough members of Congress to override a veto to pull appropriations for war, you can stop the war and the president will listen, and at least always has to date. And as you may know, after the bombing in Lebanon and after the debacle in Somalia in 1983 and 1999, I believe, I might have the dates wrong, Congress in both instances passed laws telling the president to pull out within 60 or 90 days and that appropriations would be cut off, and the president listened. So to say that Congress still has massive potential power to control war, especially through appropriations. And in some other tiny respects, I mean, I've skipped over lots of things. Congress still is involved, especially with things like covert action. It's heavily involved in scrutinizing with special operations forces. It's very involved in a secret, kind of below the radar screen, has very good relations with DOD and scrutinizing that. But the appropriations power is a very powerful power if Congress wants to exercise it.
And that kind of leads into this one. What is the situation in Iran for presidential powers and congressional powers?
As I said, the situation in the Middle East right now is that given the very, very expansive definitions of self-defense, it's basically in President Biden's discretion what to do. I mean, I'd have to know more facts about what the situation is that I was responding to, but every plausible situation on the table in the Middle East, vis-a-vis Syria, vis-a-vis Iran, vis-a-vis the Houthis, vis-a-vis the Palestinians, vis-a-vis any entity that's aggressive towards Israel, it's in the president's discretion how to respond. And I mean seriously in the president's discretion. The president could have exercised self-defense in response to that Iranian attack, not just by blocking those many missiles, but by attacking Iran. That would have been lawful under our Constitution. Right there, that's the president's call. That's a sobering thought. Whatever you think, that's a sobering thought. That's one person's call.
Darn, I thought we'd have some magic
Sorry about
solution.
That. No, I don't.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a discussion hosted by the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations with author and legal scholar Jack Goldsmith. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.